This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky. I remembered my line this week.
You did remember your line. I can get myself recorded, apparently. I'm knocking on wood. We lit candles here. I don't know what... It's Glitchfest 2024. But today we are talking about the It Books of March of 2024. Because believe it or not, we are into March here before a few days away. I guess you'll be hearing this, if you're listening to it pretty quick after release, maybe toward the tail end of February, but we're into the year, and boy, the last couple weeks of February really showed it, and March is a really very, very strong month, I would say,
starting
for books like you and I are interested in. I guess overview, Rebecca, so far, we were just talking about some of our recent reading, other things we're doing for the show. It's turning into a pretty good spring, I would say. On the whole, January was rough, but a pretty good spring.
January was rough. February has been nice. I've had some enjoyable reading time, and I was just looking at all the releases that I've marked for personal reading for March, having one of those like really coming face to face with the fact that time is finite moments. Like, there's no way I'm going to get to all of these. There are a few months every year that really do that, where it's like, no matter how good my intentions are, I'm going to miss a few that I really would like to get to, and I'm trying to figure out which ones are going to make the cut first. Do that like priority shuffle. March is looking really good.
Very good. Yeah, I had a similar thought between a January where it felt like I could read everything I was interested in because the lineup was weak. And being in a pretty good reading groove, I was like, I've got this. I'm going to read them all. I'm going to read all the books. I got finally.
Can't be stopped. Yeah.
Yeah. And then between, I got COVID and then just some bumps in my reading patterns, and suddenly I'm behind the eight ball again and trying to swim to catch up with everything that I would like to read and we want to do on the show. Anyway, for those of you who this might be your first time listening to an It Books segment, we talk about 10 books that I have selected. We take them one at each other and they knock out each other to decide what the It Book of the year, the month is going to be. And it is a vibes-based process that also has some of our experience, intuition, and other things we may or may not know about what's going on with these books. It's not just sales. It's not just people who ride the F train in Brooklyn. It's not just what we think is going to win an award. It's a little bit of everything. The perfect book does it all. Those are unusual. So usually there's a book or two that rises to the fore because of the strength of one or two quadrants. By the end, I pick them and mostly let Rebecca decide what goes on. I break the tie.
Mostly, yeah.
Generally speaking, mostly. That is not to say I do not have my opinion and try to influence the judge about what may go on. But ultimately, I try to have seeded the field, but I'm not going to reap it at the same time.
You've only come in off the top rope a couple of times, and you did let me get my hottest take ever kind of, unimpeded a couple of months ago.
Right.
So it's a fun time.
Okay. So with that, we're going to do a first sponsor break and then get into the list.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Scribner. Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman is a collection of seven stories in which characters pursue their obsessions on paths to glory and destruction, while all around them their worlds twist and warp, oscillating between reality and impossibility. On display throughout is Cotman's ability to reveal truth about the human experience, about things like friendship, love, betrayal, bitterness, all through whimsy, horror, and fantasy. Elegiac in tone, imaginative, and humorous in their execution, the character-driven stories in Weird Black Girls challenge, incite, and entertain. The author's last book was named one of NPR's best books of the year and was a finalist for the Philip K. Dick Award, with reviews appearing in the New York Times, Wired, BuzzFeed, and Locus, among other publications. Definitely make sure to check out Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman. And thanks again to Scribner for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode.
Up first, The Hunter by Tana French comes out March 5th, 2024. It is the second in this series that features a retired Chicago police officer who was retired into the rural hinterlands of West Ireland. And, you know, he just wants to till some stuff, work in the shed, putter, drink some tea.
Tilling some stuff. Doesn't
have a
sound
swift
awful.
Half at the pub.
Yeah.
It sounds great, but you know what? People get killed, Rebecca. And if you're a cop, you can't stand by if you're a former cop with a hoard of gold that does things its own way. I really like the first book in this. There's not a series, but this character is reappearing again the first time in The Searcher. I recommend it to a bunch of people. I will be reading this very, very soon after it comes out on my iPad. March 5th from Viking. I don't love to see 480 pages. Oh, would you like to hear? Do we need any more details about? There's
no.
An English millionaire, a good-looking kid.
Okay.
Yeah. Does it matter what the actual plot is? I don't think it does.
I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, it's dangerous to live in Tana French's Ireland in the same way that it's dangerous to live in like Angela Lansbury's Maine.
It seriously is very dangerous.
I think this is exciting. If you're a Tana French fan, like a second book from a familiar character is not the greatest entry point for a new reader. And Tana French is coming, I think will for the rest of her career probably be coming off the huge peak of her first, was it trilogy? The Dublin Murder Squad?
Yeah.
That was just when you come out of the gate with such a big hit, like she's having a great career. Nobody needs to be sad for Tana French, but those first three were so huge. I think she's maintained a dedicated core of readers. It's a question for me how many new readers she is gathering versus is this just sort of folks hanging on who have been reading her for a long time. It's notable when there's a new Tana French book. It will almost definitely be good. People will like it. People will read it. They'll do what you did. They'll recommend it to folks.
Right.
But she's not likely to be up for awards fodder. It's not super zeitgeisty because we know what a Tana French novel is now, what a Tana French mystery feels like. I think this deserves to make the list, kind of understand why either you or the random number generator put it in first. Not likely to progress very far. very unlikely, especially in this month's field, to win, but it's certainly worth noting.
Yeah, I wondered about maybe the, I don't know how calculating the effort was to make the protagonist American in this new series, to try to cross the pond and get, I assume, I don't know this for sure, but my mental model is that she is quite a bit more popular on the other side of the Atlantic, though she's quite popular here. But to break out here, could this do, you know, what's the upside? I don't think it's Kristen Hanna-like numbers. I just linked in today in Books Today that Kristen Hanna's new book is selling. That's a shock to everyone, I know. but can we get into the mix here? Richard Osman seems to have blown up her spot in terms of the most beloved writer of intellectual mysteries, I think, over there. And if there's ever going to have a little bit of spike, usually it's the second book in a series because it took a little while for people to have the first one and get around to it. But this is going to be fun, and I'm going to really look forward to it and recommend it. But I think your general
yeah. And I wonder too, like,
is correct.
Cozy seems to be the vibe lately, and Tana French is far from cozy. So I wonder if she's suffering.
Yeah, I don't know if it's far from cozy. Like, it's not super bloody, and it's like not like Victor Laval or something like that, where it converge onto horror. But cozy, I don't think it is. Okay, let's move on. Maktub. An inspirational companion to The Alchemist by one Paulo Coelho, an essential companion to the inspirational classic, filled with timeless stories of reflection and rediscovery. From one of the greatest writers of our age, settle down, marketing copy, comes a collection of stories and parables unlocking the mysteries of the human condition. Gathered from Paulo Coelho's daily column of the same name, Maktub, meaning it is written, invites seekers on a journey of faith, self-reflection, and transformation. Okay, I got to stop.
thank you.
I put it on here because The Alchemist sold all the books and continues to sell. And I noticed this. The marketing, I think, is quite smart. This is repackaged column material. There's nothing here to get excited about if you know, follow Coelho's career. This is, you know, putting it all back together. Now, having said that, would anyone pick this up because it has The Alchemist on it? I do not know what his follow-on readership is like. There's been other books. I can't name a single one of them. Yeah. I know they sold to some degree, but they've probably sold, what, one-tenth what The Alchemist has done?
That I think if you can do one-tenth of what The Alchemist has done, that would be incredible.
Incredible, yeah.
Yeah, this... I was on Today in Books duty when this book announcement came out, the week that came out, and I remember being like, okay, I just need to take an existential sigh and know that this is going to sell probably a lot of copies, also probably not nearly as many as The Alchemist sold. But when you're coming on, like, he's got decades of fandom for The Alchemist. And I don't know, my hope is that decades after The Alchemist changed your life, you have some different perspective on The Alchemist. But I think there are enough people holding on to, like, make it worth it for them to do this, especially since, as you were saying, they're just repackaging existing material. I really don't know how many folks are out there, like, waiting for there to be a new Paulo Coelho book. Because you regress to the mean, especially after something like The Alchemist. Does anybody have two life-changing books in them? I don't know.
It's unusual. If I liked The Alchemist better, it'd be a wonderful first edition, you know, oral history of how The Alchemist became The Alchemist. Because I don't actually know what the, you know, I don't know what the glide path was for. Path, the exit velocity. This is a rocket ship.
Yeah, I wonder if it's similar to, like, The Prophet. I had fun doing an episode on The Prophet.
Yeah, that's right. Go check out Annotated.
I wonder... this is an interesting first pairing, because Tana French
I made it tricky. I'm playing with you a little bit in my pairing here.
Tana French is, you know, writing on current fandom. And you know what you're going to get. And it has the genre situation of, like, it's familiar tropes. It will have a resolution at the end. Now, I don't think that Tana French and Paulo Coelho are competing for the same readers. So I'm talking myself into a false dichotomy. But in terms of zeitgeistiness, if this Paulo Coelho is successful, I think it will be a marketing success, not a readers love it success. And so for that reason alone, I'm going to pass Tana French through instead.
Okay, moving on. I got the sort of throat clearing ones out of the way here. Now it gets more interesting for us, I guess, as readers, or like to think about these kinds of things. Parasol Against the Axe, which is a hell of a title.
It is.
And it wouldn't surprise you to hear that that hell of a title that is jarring and alluring at the same time, it's not the worst way to describe the work of Helen Oyeyemi, who wrote, I mean, Pieces, Gingerbread. This is a novel. I'm going to read I'm going to do three sentences of the synopsis, and we're going to need to regroup and unmelt our minds. Here we go.
Okay.
A novel about competitive friendship and the elastic boundaries of storytelling and the meddling influence of a city called Prague. Not Prague, a city called Prague.
Hmm.
In this joyous new novel, the Czech capital is a living thing, one that can let you in or spit you out. Hero Tejosua accepts an invitation she was half expected to decline and finds herself in Prague on a bachelorette weekend hosted by her estranged friend. Little does she know, she's arrived in the city with a penchant for playing tricks on the unsuspecting. I have no idea what this is going to feel like, Rebecca, after reading that. What?
Me neither.
What is that?
Oyeyemi tends to have this like modern fable feeling
yes.
to her work. But this, like, the city is alive and can play tricks on you feels kind of China Mieville to me. Like, more...
It's like Sex in the Kafkin City. I don't know what
yes.
this is. It's very strange.
Speculative-y in a way that that I haven't read Oyeyemi being before. I think this will either be great or we will hear nothing about it. It's hard for me
like,
to...
Huh.
Yeah. Huh. It's hard. Or right. It'll be like a collective, huh, where no one knows what to do uh-huh. with it. And that's really possible with her. She's a challenging read, or she can be on the challenging side. So in terms of like, I'd be very surprised to see this get, you know, like a Reese's Book Club, big visibility situation like that. I don't think that's going to happen. It's been a while since we've had a Helen Oyeyemi novel, and I forget the details, but I recall like around Me Too time, there was some criticism of how she handled some gender stuff in one of the previous books. That's all I remember about it, which tells you.
That's all I remember too. Yeah.
Yeah. That like whatever the details were, at least in the, you know, 7 years since have like faded into seeming not bad enough to remember in their specificity, which could mean all kinds of things.
Right.
So I don't know if there are, I really don't have any idea what to expect.
Are there champions out there? I mean, you're kind of going circuitous.
Are there champions out there? Right. Will there be champions? Is book media going to be excited about it?
Right.
Will people like quietly read it but not feel like they should talk about it on Twitter because someone might get mad at them because Helen Oyeyemi handled something, you know, less than great in a past book? I think a whole breadth of reactions to it is possible. It's also possible that like now that we're 7 years out of the hottest moments of Me Too, people might have like cooled on that criticism. Again, I don't remember what the specifics were, so I don't remember if it's like criticism you could have cooled on. I think Tana French is the better bet here for a lot of reasons. But Oyeyemi, worth being on the list.
Yep. After that, we are going to The Morning Side by one Tia Obret, which is not her second novel. It is her third novel, as a listener was very gently, and I say that non-euphemistically.
Yeah, it was a gentle correction.
And even included a story about reminding their partner about their second novel. Also, you can see that email in one of the past issues of the Book Riot podcast newsletter and my response to it. If you'd like to, Obret made a big splash with The Tiger's Wife. This is the third novel. Let's see. After being expelled from their ancestral home in the not-so-distant future, Sylvia and her mother finally set her at the Morning Side, a crumbling luxury tower in a place called Island City, where Sylvia's aunt Edna serves as the superintendent. She feels unmoored, and there's something secretive, and the city's half under... Okay, again, I'm kind of in the same space. Like, I need to stop actually trying to figure out what it's about, because this is about how it feels. It feels to me like this may not be fair, because The Tiger's Wife had some elements of there. Let's tap into some Emily St. John Mandel vibes is what this is what feels like is trying to happen here. Could be right, could be wrong. Interested to see. Inland, as I said before, the second book didn't do much to my memory, at least to me. this is a real test of, you know, this is coming out from Random House. If this doesn't do very well, does her next book come out from Random House, if you hear what I'm saying?
Yes, that's the question I have too. And it makes me want to go back and Google, did she get a two-book deal after The Tiger's Wife and this is the end of it?
Maybe.
I think that's possible. When in March is this one out? I don't have it on.
19th.
Okay, so we're only a couple weeks out. I am concerned for Taya Obrecht that I have not heard anything about this from anybody.
Yeah.
And that's kind of all I have to say about that. So Tana French rolls on.
Wow, okay, here we go. We're cooking now. Memory Piece by Lisa Coe. Her last book, was it first book? I can't remember. The Leavers was a really good novel, also about friendship, also unusual. This next one is called Memory Piece. Three friends in the early 80s, and it sounds like the book follows them all the way in the into the 2040s. So a multi-generational saga of friendship, Rebecca. Are you sitting
Love
down?
That.
Do you need a moment to fan yourself a little bit? One is a coder, one is a performance artist, and the other is a community organizer.
Interesting.
And they live in the same neighborhood in New York City several decades in the future. I think this sounds pretty great.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I love this. I'm really glad that the multi-generational saga is like expanding beyond the typical family stuff and into friendships and other, you know, kinds of long-running relationships. This is unlikely to beat out Tana French unless it gets a big book club pick, and it could. This has book club convo written all over it.
And it could be good. I mean, this is the kind of thing. She's already been nominated for the National Book Award, like a finalist, the Leavers. So there's some bona fides here. If you're picking this a little bit, you're like, okay, it's early in the year. Let's see how this all shakes out when it comes to Penn Awards and National Book Critics Circle Awards and stuff like that later.
It's definitely a higher likelihood for awards fodder than Tana French is. It would really shock me if it outsold Tana French. Again, though, if it's a big book club pick, it could outsell Tana French. Yeah. I think I'm going to be willing to take this bet. I'll be surprised if this ends up being the it book of the month, but I'm willing to like bet on it for a little bit and just like, let's go for a
fun
ride.
You know, there's some books left and you know how I do. So this is a cowardly, bold pick by you to have Memory Piece.
Listen, I'm not the one who put it in this slot on the list, but I'm going to ride with Lisa Coe for at least one round.
All right.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon, The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild-at-heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult / crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode.
Speaking of cowardly picks, sometimes we put one in for us And this one is There's Always This Year on Basketball and Ascension by Hanif Abdurraqib, which is coming out March 26th from Random House. A poignant personal reflection on basketball life and home. He also wrote Little Devil in America, a book that you recommended to me. We both really liked and have recommended in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. This is about basketball. Basketball writing, I think, is a different show. Is having a interesting bit of a moment between Ross Gay and Abdurraqib, and there's some other stuff I've seen in the offing. I'm fascinated to see what this is going to be. I don't know if it's a series of essays. I really can't tell. It doesn't sound like it is. It sounds like it's a... It also doesn't say it's a memoir. A poignant personal recollection. What is that?
Don't ask questions, man. Just let it happen.
I don't understand. Is each chapter going to be about LeBron and then street ball and then, you know, I don't know.
I'm thinking of it as...
How they intersect with other things. I'm just not sure.
Abdurraqib is usually like... my life through the lens of X, or this thing through the lens of my life, and they move back and forth. So while A Little Devil in America is mostly like a kind of cultural criticism, it's infused with a lot of memoir elements. And I think this is going to be a similar vibe on basketball. Basketball is central to his life. He's also like, he plays basketball. He's a huge fan. He's, you know, written extensively about LeBron. He does other kinds of sports writing. I would guess it's going to be essay collection-ish. But there will be threads that like weave through the whole thing. How discreet
basketball
the
might
essays
be the beat,
are.
And then each individual topic or section will be a improvisation or variation that connects some other piece to the underlying rhythm of basketball.
Listen, nothing would make me more delighted than for Hanif Abdurraqib to get really famous and sell a metric ton of books. This is one for us probably here. I think he'll sell. It might be nominated for some things.
I think there's a very good chance of that.
Definitely fandom among like the literary internet. Also, not for nothing, he has a reputation as just being like a great dude, and I think people are looking for opportunities to give him a bigger platform. But the Lisa Co has that book clubby potential that can really help you skyrocket sales. So I think it's going to be Lisa Co for another round, but like Hanif is the winner in my heart for sure.
Yeah, if we had a separate nonfiction track, it'd be a strong contender for the month, for sure.
Yeah, nonfiction has a hard time in these.
It does have a very hard time in these, unless you're a David Gran or I don't even know what else at this point is breaking through. Next up, Anita De Monte Laughs Last by Xochitl Gonzalez. This is her second novel after Olga Dies Dreaming, comes out March 5th, so next week. It is a... I've read this, I should say. So I guess I'll save it for some other conversation, but it's sort of a two-pronged narrative. There's one about an artist who is the titular Anita De Monte in the 80s New York and international art world, and then a young undergraduate art history student who has an occasion to encounter the woman's work. It's fraught. It's about identity, and it's about inheritance. It's about culture and memory and forgetting and who gets to tell whose stories and why and what happens. I really like this book. Starred review in Publishers Weekly. It's got one of these electric, ready for Instagram covers. Easily could see it as one of the... I can see right now that it is in a kind of a sweet spot for the big time book clubs. I don't know if it'll get picked for it, but it is upmarket literary fiction that is about something and feels like it's about something, but it's also not... It's a fun read. And I'm not saying that disparaging at all.
Yeah, no.
It's a fun read.
It's good,
it turns pages.
Like it.
There's some drama and characterization stuff that's really interesting. So there you go. Anita De Monte Last by Xochitl Gonzalez. I guess we're up against Lisa Ko still at this point with Memory Piece.
Man, Xochitl Gonzalez just came out of the gate with such a hit the first time around. And I don't think we've seen her biggest splash. That first one, Olga Dies Dreaming, was big, but wasn't so big that you're like, okay, just expect that everything else will be smaller because it's, you know, in rarefied air. I feel like she's still on the rise. So I'm going to go with Anita De Monte. I'm looking forward to this one.
If we were still in peak TV, a 6-episode limited series about this would have been extremely... Ooh. I mean, it'd be cool anyway. Mm-hmm. Possible. The possibility of this thing happening has changed considerably right now. There's a couple of... There's one at least wonderful part for someone to play.
Okay.
Well, Anita DeMonte, that's not a spoiler. I'm trying not to spoil it. I'm not used to having read these things beforehand, so I'm a little tongue-tied, even more than usual when it comes to describing books, because I don't know what to say and what not to say. Okay. Up next, clocking in at 144 pages on March 12th from Knopf, is Until August by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Mm.
This is the posthumously rediscovered novel by... I don't know. What are we going to say? One of the great writers of the 20th century? I don't know what you want me to do here. Sitting alone besides the languorous blue waters of the lagoon, Anna Magdalena Bach contemplates the men at the hotel bar. She's been happily married for 27 years, has no reason to escape the life she has made with her husband and children. And yet, every August, she travels by ferry here to the island where her mother is buried, and for one night takes a new level. Like the swallows to Capistrano. Anna comes back.
Put this right into my veins.
For a hook. This is kind of it. This sounds great. It's like a novella, right? It's like a very slight and slender premise.
Yeah.
It sounds pretty cool. I'm almost wondering if this book had Elena Ferrante on it, are people more interested in it?
Maybe.
Yeah, right?
It is. I mean, it's the kind of novel now that could break a female writer's career in a new direction, probably.
Yes.
This is the kind of thing that like women writers are doing now, a little bit more of a like a wish fulfillment, empowerment, like however you want to spin it. It's an edgy idea. There's a story in Megan Mayhew Bergman's latest short story collection that's like the 4-day a week wife, the part-time wife, I think is the title, and it's a similar idea. It's this woman tells her husband, like, I'll be your wife for 4 days a week and the other 3 days are mine. I'm seeing that theme kind of coming up in a lot of places. I mean, who's gonna compete with Gabriel Garcia Marquez? Obviously.
I don't know. I'm very torn. Like, we've seen posthumous novels before, and it's unusual. I don't know what to make of it. Like, what's the one that... I mean, it's Ghost at a Watchman. We saw Juneteenth with Ellison. Like, we weren't doing this then, but...
This is tough.
Very tough.
Marquez is one... Like, first of all, his reputation posthumously has not been ruined by revelations about bad stuff.
No. Also writing out a different era of sexual politics. I don't know how this... I mean, this could have been written 40 years ago.
Right.
For all we know.
Book people will care, but general readers will not. Like, there's this piece of my heart wants to be like, obviously Marquez just takes this.
Yeah.
But I think the smart bet for what will be zeitgeisty, what will sell, what might have big book club potential, what might get nominated for awards is Xochitl Gonzalez. So I guess email her, since now you have interviewed her, and tell her that we've weighed in and no pressure, but we think she's going to beat Gabriel Garcia Marquez this month.
Greatest South American novelist of all time. You know, you nipped him in the bud here. Okay, moving right along. The Prisoner's Throne, a novel of Elfheim, Volume 2 by Holly Black. We are in commercial, fantasy, series, big-time author, Little Brown for Young Readers, March 5th, 2024. Holly Black writes these fairy, fae? I don't know what we're supposed to say anymore. The pronouns for fairies elude me, what I'm supposed to be using at this point.
What a sentence.
So this is our representative from the part of the book reading world in which we do not participate, moves a ton of units. You know, we need to at least look over there to see what's going on. And this is the one I found for this month.
All right. Book two gives me pause. Like, you're not going to jump into a big fantasy series if you haven't read book one. This will probably sell more books than most of the other books we're talking about today by virtue of being a big YA fantasy situation. There's TikTok ability here. I haven't seen, you know, like award nominations for the first one.
Holly, I mean, they Black. Don't. I mean, all of right. them, Sarah J. Maas, none of them are in award. I mean,
right.
none of
these are
Fourth Wing. None of them are in award.
They sell, contenders. But they're not going to be critically acclaimed.
Yeah.
There's not like enduring literary legacy for most popular genre.
That's true.
I'm going to go with Xochitl Gonzalez still.
Okay. All right. All right. Let's move. Last up, and I put it in the stinger spot.
Okay.
Because it is James by Percival Everett. Percival Everett, who couldn't be striking harder with a hotter iron. Right now,
so happy
coming
about
off
this.
American fiction and a decade's worth of good feeling towards the kinds of people who care about literary presses and literary writing, making his debut with a big five publisher, Doubleday, James is his reimagining of Huckleberry Finn, largely from now James's point of view. You might know him better in the book as Jim. American Fiction, which is based on his book Erasure, has a really good chance to win some awards. Adapted screenplay, I think, is probably the best. Jeffrey Wright, I think, has a real chance, too.
I think so.
This is coming out, like, I think the Oscars are right before this?
Yeah, the Oscars are on the 10th, and this is the 19th.
Good Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real chance of putting a checker on a checker. If American Fiction wins adapted screenplay, this book comes out the next week. Early reviews have been excited and interested. It's the, again, I don't know what this is going to be, but it's almost like American Fiction is about the kind of book Percival Everett is writing now, but also not. So it's very meta in a way. So I'm completely excited. I can barely contain myself.
Me too.
Rebecca, I have to assume this is going to be the pick, which is why I put it
yes,
here.
Smart.
Is there any reason not to?
Or no, what else to this say is about James this Bush is Robert? The one. I got a finished hardcover in the mail, and it is everything I can do not to read it early, because we're going to do a book club episode of it for the Patreon in early April, like a few weeks after the book comes out. We'll do that episode, and I try to do that reading closer in. So from like the 19th on, I'm just going to have to like put my blinders on when I go online.
Yeah, this is one of my rare pre-orders.
To
make sure that this comes in when I want it.
This was, I think, my number one pick in our winter draft.
Yeah.
And I was coming off of having read Erasure for the first time. I don't know that there's a writer I'm more excited to catch up on everything they've written than Percival
there's
Everett.
There's a lot, too. There's a bunch of books.
There is a lot, and I've only read a handful of them. I hope that Cord Jefferson and crew win for Best Adapted Screenplay. And we're going to talk about some Best Adapted Screenplay theories next week. And they stand on stage and they go, and if you loved this movie, go pick up James by Percival Everett next week when it comes out. Like, perfect platform. The book looks beautiful. It's just a wonderful addition to a spin on a classic story told from a minor character's perspective. And the way that Everett will do that, I have so much faith, is going to be sharp and funny. We had a question from a listener on our...
Yeah, I was just thinking about this.
Yeah, on our Patreon mailbag episode a few weeks ago, who is Canadian, so that's like a wrinkle in their relationship to it, but who as an adult had just read Huck Finn for the first time and was like, this is terrible. Like, the language and the way that they treat the black people and all of it is awful. What do we think about this? Does Huckleberry Finn still matter? And you and I landed in the place of like, it does if you want to understand American literature and what satire was at the time. Like, this was Huck Finn was the sharpest kind of satire at the time that it came out. Nobody was writing more pointedly than Twain was, at least for a mass audience. I think Percival Everett there are real analogs to be made, or analogies to be made, between how Everett writes now, and for him to take on a character like Jim from a book like Huckleberry Finn and do the kinds of things that we know he can do is so exciting. I'm like beside myself for this to come out. I also hope he gets just super famous and very rich off of it. And not for nothing, I think there's book club potential here too. Get your book club together and like talk about this perspective on an American classic and what it must have been like to be Jim in a book where Jim was not the center of the story. Man, Yes.
It's there's so many angles here.
There's so
John
many.
John Clinch wrote a book called Jim about 10 years ago, a white writer from, I think, mm-hmm. Missouri himself, who I think it felt like a more traditional, from a different character's point of view, in addressing the slights and overlookingness and underestimations yeah. of the original book. I thought it was good. And Everett, I can't imagine he's going to do that. I mean, I don't want to say just that, because that's worth doing in a lot of different ways, mm-hmm. and people have done it. You know, White Sargasso Sea, there's a long history
yes.
of a pretty straightforward, serious, and subversive take on a character that didn't get their just due. But this is going to be, I feel like it's also going to be about that. Like, Everett's books tend mm-hmm. to be about the thing they're about, and they're also about
yes.
being about the thing they're about.
Yeah, there's like a metafictional element and yeah. a meta-metafictional element to the way that he writes.
And I don't know exactly what that angle is going to be, which I'm excited about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what his take, for lack of a better term, on Twain is going to look like.
Yeah. And, I mean, he can just write. The writing will be great. The sentences will be delightful and surprising, and they will move. Dude can write a page turner.
Yep.
And that combination of, like, it's about a pretty serious thing. You're taking an American classic and all of the connotations that come with that. You're turning it on its head in some ways. There are people who will probably clutch their pearls at what Percival Everett has done to a beloved character. And that's part of the mm-hmm. idea, too. He's here to make you clutch your pearls. I'm so excited about this one. I can't wait to talk about it.
You know how you know that Everett is a razor-sharp genius at the height of his game who knows all the angles?
Hmm.
320 pages.
Yeah, the book is beautiful, and it's a reasonable size.
Yeah. And Oprah has it in her.
She does. Oh, I forgot. It's been a while since we had an Oprah pick. We haven't had
one
since
Jasmine. Morning.
Oh, there was
one pick this morning.
I missed it.
Yeah,
okay.
The title was unfamiliar to me, so I don't have the tip of my tongue. But this is a month later. You know, and she mm-hmm, can pick it later. Mm-hmm. She's done that before.
Yeah.
Again, Oprah, it's been a while. I can't, what's the most difficult recent Oprah pick?
But the Jasmine
I cannot
Ward.
Get out of my head. Yeah, that's true. That she picked a box set of Faulkner back in the day. The
yeah.
biggest flex of all time for Oprah.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, Tolstoy and Toni Morrison.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying, like,
she does
can
have it in her.
Pull one out of the bag. She's not afraid if she wants to throw a curveball
mm-hmm.
or a breaking ball or a knuckleball or whatever you want to do, where you don't really see that, at least to my knowledge. I don't follow the other ones as closely, the GMA or Jenna or Reese
yeah.
or whoever else it might be.
I would love
but
to see that
one,
happen.
I wouldn't be super surprised.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be super surprised either way. Fully expect this to be in the conversation
oh,
at
yeah.
the end of the year.
Yes.
Talk about, it's kind of like when someone gets nominated for an Academy Award that hasn't won, like, you know, when mm-hmm. Scorsese won for The Departed and it was like his yeah. 15th best movie, but he just hadn't won before.
Like, we're just doing this for the body of work.
It's yeah, yeah, it's like we have a chance here. We have the tree to hang the ornament on. And I also think there's a chance this tree is the tree that people can understand
right.
better.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done this before. He's taken literary characters. The most recent one I can think of is in Dr. No. Not a specific, I mean, it is a specific Bond character name, but it's a different kind of character, and did something completely different yeah. about it. And I still am scratching my head in a good way about what that book is about.
It's great.
So it's exciting. This is an exciting kind of a book
yeah.
from a major publisher at the right time in a long,
and
long time for me.
Also, adaptation potential. We're past peak adaptation, but there's room for this, especially if American Fiction does really well at the Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what the story is going to be? Because it could go any, I mean, literally mm-hmm. could do anything. I'm not
yeah,
hyperbole
no,
for me.
No, it's, yeah, that's the wonderful thing about Everett is, like, every book is a different topic. He moves between genres. He's done all mm-hmm. kinds of stuff. You just never know. Like, Half an Inch of Water, I think, was my first Percival Everett experience. And it's a collection of short stories, like, set in the American West, kind of about cowboy life. But, you know, he's a black man. Some of the cowboys in the stories are black men. That's a really different experience and a different
yeah.
kind of story to tell than like Yellowstone. And you just don't know right. how different it's going to be until you get in there and see whatever it is doing. And that there's like multiple vectors and layers of surprise makes him so much fun to read. It's just such a good time. Like we've been collectively excited about this. And excited about the new Tommy Orange and excited about the mm-hmm. Salman Rushdie memoir. And I think those will be probably like the three big reading experiences of yeah. this season. But in terms of like what is just I'm going to have the most fun with and it will be good, it's got to be this.
Yeah. Fascinating. I mean, he's been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize finalist. I think that was for Dr. No as well. Maybe something earlier before, like The Trees is a really interesting. I mean, I'm just like quickly looking at some of the stuff and it's hard to wrap your head around. And it is exciting, too, that you have a modern master who's yet undiscovered by most people that walk into a Barnes & Noble. Like my dad mm-hmm. doesn't know. Well, yeah. before, I mean, if I asked him today, who wrote the book American Fiction is based on, he wouldn't know the name Percival Everett. My dad's a good reader. He just is.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, you know, hasn't encountered Everett at this point.
It's fascinating. Like folks were standing around outside the theater when I went to see American Fiction, and most of them did not know that it had been based on a book. And yeah. it was like, oh, just wait though. Yeah. Now you get to discover Percival Everett. Lucky you.
All right. So that's James by Percival Everett. I knew once I saw this book mm-hmm. that it would be some way of pantomiming interest in the rest of the picks, but it's still a good slate, right? It's still yeah. a good slate of books for March.
It is. Yeah. March is looking strong. There's several here I'm looking forward to.
All right. With that, you can find the show notes, bookriot.com/listen to see all the picks there. You could also hear me on First Edition. Let me see. Well, you will not be able to hear interviews with some interested parties yet, but stay tuned for some of those coming out soon. Check out Better Living Through Books, the Book Riot Podcast newsletter, and as the aforementioned Patreon, in which over the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about The Book of Love soon. I think we record that on mm-hmm. Thursday. I'm getting through that. Lot to say about that book. I'll keep my cards close to the vest for now.
Same.
And is James, do we have that as a Patreon or as a regular
episode? We do. We have it as a Patreon.
A Patreon episode. Mm-hmm. So if you want to hear us talk more about these books, sign up for that. Some other things coming up as well. Deals, the most recent iteration of our, I guess, multi-year recurring mm-hmm. segment in which I say book deals and announcements at Rebecca and listen to her respond and then say things back and then move on to the next one.
It's a great time.
Very good time. Thank you all so much for listening. Rebecca, we'll talk to you later.
All right.